More and more teenagers and young adults are walking away from faith, but why? Has the church become irrelevant? When people reconsider what it is they really believe, what is it that makes some people stay on Team Jesus and many others walk away from Christianity? Is it about what's actually true, or does it have to do with how you feel and experience the world? We're going to be talking about all of that and so much more on today's episode of Theology on Air. Well, welcome back to Theology on Air. I am Sarah Stone, Outreach Director for Young Adults at MDPC, and joined for the first time on one of these, right here in real life. I could poke him if he says something offensive to me. This is Evan McClanahan, pastor at First Lutheran in a Midtown, downtown Houston. And we are joined
for sharp objects.
I have nails though. We're joined today by a very special guest. I'm really excited. Brett Kunkel, who is the founder and president of Maven. We're going to learn a little bit more later about that name and what it's about, but it's a movement to equip the next generation to know truth, pursue goodness, and create beauty for the cause of Christ. He has more than 25 years of experience working with youth and parents. In addition, Brett is a teaching fellow at the Impact 360 Institute. He was an associate editor for the Apologetic Study Bible for students. That's pretty cool. And co-authored A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World, and A Student's Guide to Culture. He received his master's degree in philosophy of religion and ethics from Talbot School of Theology. And Brett lives with his wife and five kids. Wow. In Southern California, where apparently the air is still not great. So Brett, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you.
Hey, Sarah, Evan, it's good to be with you guys.
Yeah. And for those of you that may not know, Theology on Air is a ministry born out of Theology on Tap, which is a monthly event for Houston young adults where we drink craft beer and we talk about interesting and relevant topics of culture, faith, philosophy, religion, the Bible, Christian living, all of that fun stuff. So come and join us. Our next one, I don't know when this podcast is going out, so this may be after, but the next one is on October 13th, How to Not Divorce Your Family This Thanksgiving, talking about politics and religion and doing so with love. Should be interesting. So, so Brett, you do a lot of work with youth, and there's a lot of talk these days about people walking away from faith. Tell us just a little bit first to start us off why you're so passionate about this, how you kind of got involved in this. I know there's some story about you being dismantled by your college professor. Tell us a little bit about that and how you got into being passionate about these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I grew up in a Christian home. My parents, they were saved when I was just a baby. My dad grew up in a Lutheran home, but he was not a believer. He ends up marrying my mom, who is from Vietnam, and she's culturally Buddhist. And so they both were not believers, get saved when I'm a baby. So I end up being raised in the church. And it was a great experience. My experience in the church was wonderful. Was part of a couple of really good churches. In junior high, I got involved in a youth group where my youth pastor was a huge mentor. And then my junior year in college, I decide to go into full-time ministry and do youth ministry. And, so this is kind of the path I'm on. And then my freshman year in college, I'm at a junior college in Southern California. I take philosophy 101 with Professor David Lane. And that semester, he proceeds to, dismantle my faith. And it was, he wasn't the angry, maybe the stereotypical angry professor coming against the, the poor Christian. He was actually maybe one of the most popular professors on campus. He was a charismatic guy. He was a surfer. So I surf. And so I looked up to him for that, but very intelligent. And what we would do is we would just discuss all the big issues of life, God's existence, religious views, ethical views. And there would just be times in class where he would specifically take aim at a Christian view. And as we would discuss, it became apparent that I was a Christian. So he would specifically, challenge me in class. Mm-hmm. And I remember times where he would ask me questions or ask me to defend a Christian position on something, and I had no idea how to answer. And so I would decline. And then he would kind of, in a kind of a gracious way, he would try to draw me out, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would sit there embarrassed because I didn't know how to answer these questions. So I thought, I'm a Christian. I got to defend this stuff. And so I would go to his office after class so I wouldn't be embarrassed in front of all my, you know, my classmates. And he would just, he would destroy my views. Mm-hmm. And I remember the last time I was in his office, he said, "Brett, do you have a Bible on you?" And of course, I was a good Christian kid, carried a Bible in my backpack. I pulled it out, you know, and he said, "Okay, get out a piece of paper and get out a pen. And I want you to draw two lines and divide that paper into three columns." And then he had me write Matthew at the top of the first column. I wrote Mark at the top of the second mm-hmm. column. I wrote Luke at the top of the third column. Right. And then he proceeded to spend the next hour with me going through the resurrection account in Matthew and Mark and Luke and writing down the details. And then, of course, showing me the differences mm-hmm. in the accounts. And then, you know, of course, his claim was that, hey, here's some contradictions. And this, you know, the biblical text isn't very reliable on this stuff. I remember just sitting there stunned. Silent. I had no answer. And I folded up the piece of paper, put it in my Bible, put my Bible in my backpack, said, "Thanks, Professor Lane," and walked out of his office and walked to my car. And I was almost trembling, just thinking, oh, you know, the implications here I thought mm-hmm. were huge. Like, does this shatter my faith? You know? And so that set me on a search to find answers. Cause I thought, if he's right and this stuff isn't accurate, well, then maybe I shouldn't believe it. And so that set me on a journey to search for answers. And through that process of doubt, God really rebuilt my faith. I discovered apologetics, which gave me a passion for that. And my faith became stronger through that process of doubt. And then I went on and I thought, hey, I'm going into youth ministry. These young people that I'm working with, many of them grow up in the church, going to have the same experience that I did. Mm-hmm. And they need to be prepared. And I thought, how sad is it that I could grow up in the church for 18 years, the first 18 years of my life, and not be prepared for these kind of challenges? For the first person to show me apparent contradictions in the biblical text was the philosophy professor. You know, what was the church hiding from me? Why didn't, you know, people talk about this stuff?
Yeah.
And so I just thought, man, the church has really fallen down in this area of equipping its young people. And so that's what gave me a passion to equip, in the next generation.
I have a similar story for me. It was Bart Ehrman's textbooks in, like religion classes, but same impact. My professor was not a believer, but he was nice. He kind of wanted me to like still be a part of a community that like could make a difference in the world. So in that sense, he didn't want me to stop being a Christian per se, but definitely Bart Ehrman's textbooks, not like his popular books. This was pre misquoting Jesus and all that. But so, yeah. I never heard any of the arguments against any of that either. So
it's interesting go ahead.
I was gonna say those stories are numerous. Yep. You know, whenever I talk about my story, I have people come up and share their same story. I talk to young people all the time and they have similar stories. And it's not just college either. It's now in high school.
Yep.
It's now in junior high school that they get those kind of challenges.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We often think of apologetics as being something that we can take out into the world and use with atheists and agnostics, skeptics, but really the first person that we need it for is for ourselves. Because then when we're hit with that kind of thing. So you said that you went and searched for answers. I'm curious, how did you do that? Where did you search for said answers? Did you just like, I always call my dad. I don't know if that's a good method for my dad is a pastor and he's very trustworthy and lovely and usually often right about things, but not everybody has a pastor dad who's often right about things. So where did you go? Yeah. How did you do that?
Well, I did go to my dad. My dad was an elder at our church mm-hmm. and I went to him and my dad will tell you his answers at that time were completely inadequate. In fact, mm-hmm. I remember being in the car with him talking about these challenges basically asking him, okay, Dad, what would you say? How do you answer these things? Mm-hmm. And I could tell he was nervous. He was squirming, like he didn't have answers. And he said, well, Brett, I just have faith. I just have faith. And I didn't say this to him at the time, but I was thinking that is completely inadequate. I cannot go back into the classroom and just tell my professor, oh, I just have faith. It sounds like you're saying this is wishful thinking. Yeah. Or faith is some, you got to throw out your mind. You got to throw out logic and truth. And so he would, you know, at this point he kind of went on that journey with me a little bit through the years as well, and would definitely change his answer now. Yeah. I went to my youth pastor, who's a huge mentor, and he didn't know how to answer the challenges at, initially, but he said, hey, I'm going to help you look for answers. And so he would help me wrestle with some of this. I had another friend who had some formal training in apologetics at his university, his Christian university. And so he gave me a book. He gave me a book called Scaling the Secular City by a Christian philosopher and a Christian thinker named J.P. Moreland. Mm-hmm. And that was the first apologetics book I was introduced to, which if you've ever read it, it's pretty deep stuff. It was way over my head at that point, but I was, you know, soaking some of it up and just thinking, okay, at the very least, there's a very intelligent Christian here who's engaging mm-hmm. with these, who's offering evidence, who seems to be able to respond to the challenges. And that began to open up the door to seeing this larger Christian world that was very thoughtful, that engaged, you know, the ideas of the world and didn't shy away from them. And that there were reasons and evidence. And so that kind of began my journey.
It's funny that you say there is some real comfort in looking at someone like a Ravi Zacharias or a J. Warner Wallace or somebody that has, they're clearly intelligent and thoughtful and have not checked their brain at the door and they think it's right. So like there's hope, you know, that you could get there. So I'm curious as a podcast producer, but also as a mom of teens, young people disengaging from the church and their faith. What do you think are the root causes of that? What do you think is causing, I mean, where is the church missing the mark? Where are the holes that we're not filling in before we send them off to the wolves, as it were?
Yeah, well, I think there's probably a number of things that are going on here. In fact, when I talk about doubt and unbelief, for me, it's very helpful to look at three categories of causes for this. And I think number one, there are intellectual reasons. There are intellectual reasons why people will doubt the faith and eventually walk away. And that was my story. For me, the doubt that I experienced was intellectual in nature. It was these intellectual challenges from my professor. And I could look back at that and I could see that had I not been provided solid intellectual responses, that I could have walked away. And so I think there are a lot of young people who, for them, there are these intellectual causes. And sometimes for some of them, it's not a short-term thing. Like mine was a semester class where I got all this challenge at once. And then there's this kind of, this event of being challenged. I think for a lot of our young people now, the intellectual challenge is something that happens maybe throughout their education in particular, mm-hmm. because I think they're being educated in a secular system that's giving them categories, giving them a worldview by which to kind of frame the world and think about all of these things. It doesn't resonate with what they hear at church on Sunday, or if they go to youth group or, you know, church activities where they're getting very little training anyway, you know, an hour or so a week, if that. Often parents aren't doing very systematic kind of training with their young people. So what they're doing is they're getting a worldview from the culture and they're growing up with this. And ultimately what happens by the time they're in high school, in college, the Christian worldview just intellectually seems incoherent. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem to answer all the voices that they're hearing from the culture. So when it comes to something like LGBTQ issues, right? Mm-hmm. What they hear at church is this very shallow, that's wrong, don't do that kind of message. And then the world is giving them all these other messages, and there's this just, you know, this disconnect.
I don't know who it was. I want to say Dewey. I don't know if he's the decimal system guy, but anyway, he's like the father of American public education. I think it was him who said something like, well, they can have their 1 hour a week. I've got them for 30 or something. I'm misquoting, but I do think that for a lot of people, they, you know, you look at like the disparity of just time alone. I mean, even if you go to church Sunday morning, evening, and Wednesday night, you're still outnumbered like 10 to 1 just in terms of sheer time. And I think that that worldview shaping is probably more implicit than explicit. You know, there's like in textbooks and in classes, they're not out there saying, I mean, they might be saying something like maybe evolution or LGBT or something. I mean, I've seen schools promote that sort of actively, but it's probably just such an assumed part of the culture. It just kind of comes out of the curriculum, you know? So, we're outgunned, we're outmanned a little bit, you know, not to feel sorry for ourselves, but, and like, churches may not even talk about those issues at all because they don't want to touch them. The people are terrified of, you know, bringing something like that up.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think a lot of, sadly, a lot of pastors and church leaders are, they're not equipped as well. And that's what I found generally when I was asking people in my church to kind of help me through this. They just weren't equipped to answer these kind of challenges. So, so I think there are intellectual causes. There are also, though, moral causes that underlie and drive some of our doubt and unbelief. And so I think for some young people, it's a matter of them failing morally, if you will. They struggle with sin. Maybe it's that young man in high school who gets addicted to porn and is just feeling all kinds of shame and guilt. And eventually there are moral reasons that drive them away, right? And this is Romans chapter 1, where we suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And that's one of our fundamental, you know, problems as human beings. So you'll have young people that it will be the moral stuff. Now, what happens typically, I've found, is that whenever someone struggles with doubt and unbelief, it almost always gets expressed intellectually first. And so there'll be these objections, you know, to whatever, the biblical text, or there will be objections to God or whatever. And so it's often expressed intellectually. And just sometimes you have to do a little more digging. And I think you still have to deal with those intellectual questions because sometimes it's a mix. But if you uncover more, there will be, you might be able to find that there are moral reasons. And then I think a third category of causes is, you could call it psychological or emotional doubt. And these are the folks who maybe have experienced hurt and pain in life. Maybe they've experienced hurt and pain at the hands of someone who calls themselves a Christian or, you know, from a church leader. And then that hurt and pain, they ask, why God? And then they turn their anger and their hurt and their brokenness and their bitterness, and they direct it at God and say, well, if this is the kind you got of God you are, I don't want anything to do with you. And so I think those three things are very helpful ways to categorize the things that can cause doubt: intellectual, emotional, and moral. And what we have to do with our kids is, when our kids doubt, help them navigate that and help uncover for them, you know, what is it? What is the driving, what are the driving reasons?
Yeah. Easier said than done. I mean, I think a lot of teens might not even be able to articulate some of those things, right? Or even maybe understand that they are doubting, even if they are. So I don't know if you have any tips or tricks on like what kinds of questions to ask, but I'm maybe getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but,
No, I think you're right. It's a challenge because human beings are complex creatures, right? We are soulish beings with an intellect, with rational capacities. We have a will or volitional aspects to us. We have emotional aspects. We have affections. You know, we have all these things. So it is challenging to navigate that. And I think what you said, Sarah, is the way to start, is with questions. And really, I mean, the first question kind of in general would just be asking your kids at times, well, what do they believe? Mm-hmm. You know, what do they believe about certain things? And now, of course, in order for them to share honestly, there's going to have to be an environment of some kind of safety there. Like mm-hmm. if you're ready to pounce on them, or you're ready to shut them down, or you just can't handle hearing that from your kid, well, then they're not gonna feel the freedom to be honest with you on that stuff. And I think as parents, then what we have to do is, and this I think is the same thing with a friend. If we have a friend who's struggling with doubt, same thing. If they think we're gonna pounce, or we're gonna attack them, or we're gonna get upset, or we're gonna get defensive. And I think that's probably the big challenge for parents, is not getting defensive when you hear this stuff.
Yeah.
And then kind of shutting them down. What we're going to have to do is set that stuff aside and just listen, and maybe go into those conversations with the goal that all I'm going to do is ask questions, not going to make any statements at this point, listen, and give them the freedom to ask those questions, to doubt, to kind of get that stuff out on the table. Because frankly, that's a way better strategy, is having my kids share that stuff with me, honestly, versus shutting down and not sharing it at all. Because if we ever shut down our kids' questions and doubts, they don't stop doubting. Stop asking questions.
They just take it elsewhere.
Yeah, they just stop asking you questions, you know? And look, if my kid has questions about the faith, the first person I want them to come to is me. Mm-hmm. And so I want them to feel like they can always question stuff, because I want to hear where their heart and mind is at. And if it's not me, they're going to someplace else. And, you know, I want to prevent that. So if you've got to create that openness, that space for them to, you know, share those things honestly, but asking them questions about what they believe in and about specific topics. Yeah. You know, in our home, what we do a lot is, I mean, we're kind of a news and political family. We like to stay on board with what's going on. So there's always things that are happening in the culture that give us things to discuss over the dinner table. I mean, that's one of the best tools we have, is a dinner table. Sit down together for some good food and a meal, have that table fellowship, and then just talk about things that way. And just asking our kids, like, especially, you know, we have older kids. We have quite the range. You mentioned we have 5 kids. We have a 25-year-old.
Oh, wow.
We have a 19-year-old. We have a 17-year-old. We have a 13-year-old. And we have a 9-year-old. So we have kind of all those levels of development.
Okay. Are you telling me that your 9-year-old talks about politics? Because I am going to need some tips and tricks, because my daughter checks out when we start talking about that.
No. Yeah, he does. He loves to engage. A lot of that's my wife's fault, because she loves politics. She loves history. And so they catch her passion for it as well.
Oh, I love that.
But bottom line is, we have to create that space, ask our kids what they believe, you know, about particular issues. And that'll give us a sense of where they're at on these things. But also, as you do that, as students, as our kids begin to open up about things, you've got to be a careful listener, because you will hear that there's more going on underneath the surface often. So for instance, when I talk, you know, if I'm talking to someone who's not a believer, or they've walked away or whatever, and they bring up objections, oftentimes when they bring up objections, you'll start to see them, you'll start to see some emotions bubble up. Mm-hmm. Like, they're upset about this as well. And it doesn't seem to be just an intellectual issue, but when someone gets angry or frustrated talking about this stuff, and it's not because I'm being a jerk to them or something, but, you know, when you see those emotions bubble up, that's often a tip off that, okay, this isn't merely an intellectual issue. There's probably some kind of emotional a cause here that's at work. Mm-hmm. And I find that's almost, you know, it's true almost all the time. So if my kid were to be getting upset about this, well, then that would direct the question for me to ask, like, hey, why do you feel upset about this? You seem to be, you know, angry as you talk about this. Why do you feel upset about that?
Yeah.
And again, it's kind of the whole idea of like peeling the onion, right? You're just kind of pulling back layer after layer to get at what's the core.
Yeah. No, that's good stuff. You said a lot of things I want to kind of go further in on, but you talked a little bit about culture. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about culture. Why is it such a powerful force in the live, all of our lives? And then, you know, the way that we sort of receive a lot of culture is through technology. So maybe you can kind of speak to that too, like kids in technology, but really all of us are taking in so much technology. Is that helping? Is it hurting? Is it doing both? Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. So the first question was culture. I think it's really important for Christians to define our terms, right? So the first question we ask when we come to an issue, in order to think through it carefully, is, hey, what is this thing? What is it? What do we mean when we say this word? And culture is actually, when you look into it, it's a bit of a difficult word to define because it encompasses so much. Mm-hmm. But I think culture would be a very, very concise definition would be our pursuit to take the world as it's given to us and then to make something of it. Culture, Andy Crouch kind of gives this definition in his book, Culture Making. It's what we make of the world. And so, you know, we are given a world filled with natural resources, and then we build culture. And when we think about the different aspects of culture, that's kind of helps us maybe to cash this out a little bit more. You know, you have ideas. And so culture is made up of different ideas that people take to be true or they embrace. And then they live those ideas out. Culture is also made up of groups, or it's made up of individuals, people, what we call in the book champions. So these would be everything from mom and dad to the professor at college to a pastor to celebrity, mm-hmm. Sports star, YouTube influencer. Yeah. These are all the people in the culture. They're taking ideas and propagating those and arguing for those and making a case for those different ideas of what's true and what's good and what's beautiful. Then you have groups of people, and that would be typically would organize themselves in what we would refer to as institutions. So a nonprofit organization or a group like Theology on Tap would be an institution, or the Institution of Education or the Institution of Law. These are different parts of culture that have profound influence on us. And again, that propagate different ideas. And then you also have what we call artifacts. So these are the individual things that we build, like a song or a book or clothing, are the artifacts of culture. Our homes, our buildings, our cars, these are all different artifacts of culture. And of course, that doesn't cover everything in culture, but I think it gives us a good idea of what culture is made up of and how we make culture. But what ends up happening is that ironically, we make culture, and then culture turns around and it makes us, it shapes us. And I think the most powerful way that culture shapes us is simply by presenting to us what is normal or what should be normal, mm-hmm. right? So it's not even, Lewis talks about the most powerful ideas are not the ones that are being argued, but the ones that are being assumed. And so culture presents to us what's normal, and we simply absorb that, we assume that, and that's how it shapes us. Mm-hmm. And, I think, this is a great lead into technology. Technology is one of those things. I would guess probably, 99% of your audience own smartphones. Mm-hmm. I own a smartphone. I'm sure you guys own a smartphone. So we all own smartphones. But if we ask people, hey, how many of you actually spent maybe a week or a month of researching a smartphone? And I don't mean like what model you want. I mean, researching the nature of a smartphone, thinking about, hey, how does this technology shape a human being? What are the potentials? What are the studies that we should look at in terms of any correlations between mental health and the use of this thing, mm-hmm. anything like that, right? Well, when I talk to students, like when I, I kind of bring up this analogy, they look at me like I'm from another planet. Like, of course not. None of them have ever thought, have even asked the question, should I own this thing? And if I do, how will it impact my life? Mm-hmm. Instead, what has happened is the culture presents it as normal. And yeah. so now all their friends own one. It's normalized. If you don't own one, you're abnormal. There's something mm-hmm. wrong with you. You get laughed at. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was just speaking at a chapel on yesterday morning. I was speaking to the junior hires, and I had all the students raise their hands who owned a smartphone. It was almost everybody in the room, but I knew there was at least one kid who didn't own a smartphone because I saw a couple kids turn around and they were kind of giggling, you know, at this abnormal kid who doesn't have a smartphone, you know? And so just imagine the pressure for a young person, and that kind of pressure, then they just think, okay, I need this to be normal. I need this to be accepted kind of into the mainstream. That's a great example of how culture powerfully shapes us. And you could just take this and then play it out in all kinds of issues. Take it, not smartphone ownership, but how about the ideas we adopt about, you know, current issues or current current events?
Well, and the example you gave is pretty innocuous. You know, culture says having a smartphone is the normal thing, but culture also says a lot of other things are, these were the words you used, true, good, and beautiful, or normal, that of course aren't. So yeah, then you have kids and really all of us trying to figure out, so culture tells us these things are true, good, beautiful, normal. How do I know really what is or is not? I mean, that's kind of what we're all trying to do all the time, right? Like, I mean, even in politics, you're trying to look up articles and you're like, well, this is coming from this bias and this is coming from that bias. And how could I ever know what's true?
And then the culture has ways of putting pressure on you or causing you pain if you don't get in line with certain views or lifestyles. So, I mean, we see this with, you know, some of the gender identity stuff in culture, where if you don't go along with the ideas of culture, well, then you'll be punished. And so that punishment might be some kind of social rejection. It might be, you know, hatred on a social media platform that you have to deal with. It could be even more painful where you lose a job, you know, and there's those stories out there in the culture where you don't get on board with this ideology. Well, we're going to cut you out economically. So the culture has different ways of causing pain. And so now think about this for a young person who's still developing their faith, you know, growing in their knowledge of it and their confidence of it. And then they're just hit by all these different waves from the culture, how they would need to be prepared to stand up against that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I remember a pastor once who was really into this sort of thing, talked about the brain development and, you know, the way that children's brains develop. And once they get into adolescence, what we call adolescence or teenage years, the peer group is the way their brain is forming, that everything in their body is saying the peer group's approval is the most important thing, which is why parents are like, why don't they listen to me anymore? Because they used to regard their parents as like godlike figures. I mean, literally, you know, I mean, that was the level of dependence and admiration, but that goes away. I also hate to have you watch this documentary guy, but the documentary on Netflix called The Social Dilemma.
I was going to ask about that too.
I mean, I know that we're not supposed to like Netflix these days, which is ironic because people are like, cancel your Netflix account. There's this amazing documentary on Netflix that everyone should watch. Well, like, which is it? Anyway, but yeah, The Social Dilemma talks, you know, it's all these like former or I guess current tech people saying, put your phone away, put your social media away. It's destroying us. And I've heard that Steve Jobs would be aghast at how we use the smartphone. It's kind of the typical law of unintended consequences. You know, you develop all this thing where you can mail and take pictures, but all of a sudden it becomes a thing where your face is glued to it 4 hours a day. And yeah. I don't know. So how it's like, I my kids don't have phones. They're 9 and 11. My daughter's 11 in sixth grade. She doesn't have a phone yet. Her classmates do think she's weird. And but one of the reasons is I don't want her to be like this person, you know, like staring.
For those listening on the podcast, he's just face deep in the device. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, that the social dilemma is one that it's been recommended multiple times. So I definitely want to see that. But I think it's just take it, what I've heard is it just takes all the research that's out there and puts it in kind of a compelling, you know, whatever hour and a half documentary. I think it's pretty well known that someone like Steve Jobs, he said he wouldn't even give his kids these devices that his company is making. And Silicon Valley CEOs say the same kind of thing because mm-hmm. they know exactly what they're doing with these devices. I mean, there's been articles online. One article in particular, I can't remember the title of it. I could look it up, but it was on Medium. And it was talking about how Silicon Valley CEOs and executives will bring in child psychologists to consult with them and talk, and they'll bring in neuroscientists and talk with them and figure out, hey, what are the best ways to keep these kids on our platforms, mm-hmm. right? Because, hey, I keep a kid on the platform longer, keep them addicted. There's a bottom line here for us yep. financially. And so I think with helping navigate this with our kids, we're going to have to do a number of things. I think, Evan, holding off from giving your kids one of these things is one of the best things that you can do. And I think what we'll have to do before we even do that, get to that point, is from the various youngest of ages, we're going to have to foster a kind of a counterculture in our families mm-hmm. of this thing. And one of the best things I think we can do as followers of Jesus with our families is maybe, you know, however you would do this, is repeat the mantra again and again that we are different. Hmm. We are different. And I think it would be very helpful for our kids to grow up with a sense that, this culture is, there's wonderful things in this culture. There's some really great things out there, but this culture, this world is not my home, right? My primary citizenship is elsewhere. And so we are going to look different in very important ways from the world that surrounds us. And that's okay. But really beginning to prepare our kids to begin to resist this, you know, these cultural pressures. And so I think it starts very early on by just narrating this for our kids. Hey, we're going to be different. And sadly, we sometimes have to do that even within our own churches. Mm-hmm. When you look at other families at the church, because we've kind of had those conversations with our kids where it's like, well, you know, church is the safe place, right? Well, these kids are doing, you know, such and such, or they get such mm-hmm. and such. And it's like, yeah, well, we may even be different from others in our community. And this is why we really need strong churches that can kind of be this counterculture as well. That's yeah. not in the, that's in the world, but not of the world. Right. And, but talking in these kind of ways that we are different. And so we're going to do things differently. I think modeling that for the kids, because this is certainly technology and technology addiction and these kind of things are not just a kid problem. You know, they're a human problem. And we as parents have got to, you know, we've got to be managing these things well ourselves. And that's kind of the first place, is modeling it for our kids. So if my, you know, 2-year-old is growing up in my home, seeing me bring the phone to the dinner table and every time it buzzes or beeps or rings, I'm, you know, looking at it or answering it. Well, there's not going to be a whole lot you can do to overcome that if we're modeling that yeah. kind of thing. But then holding off for as long as possible, I think, on the technology side. And as they get older, then what you have to do is not just lay down kind of, here's the rule or here's what we're doing. You also have to give the reason why. And so I think the most helpful things that we've done for our kids is we've given them the freedom to question any rule that we have mm-hmm. and, or ask us first, hey, what's the reason for this rule? And we've told them, look, if we don't have a good reason for this, and you can kind of show us how there's not a good reason, if it's just because I said so,
yeah.
Well, then we think that rule is unreasonable. There's not a good reason behind it. Then if you make a good argument, we'll change it. Mm-hmm. And so what that's forced us to do is to think carefully about these things and have good reasons for these kind of rules. And so we can kind of say, yeah, we're holding off because of this and this and this, and because of, you know, the power of this thing.
Well, it's also teaching them critical thinking skills, which is awesome, especially as we get back into the apologetics questions, which before we do, I want to tackle one other piece of kind of culture and how it influences this conversation. You mentioned earlier when you were talking about the sort of moral obstacles, perhaps something like an addiction to pornography. So, and I know, I mean, in some of the sample questions you sent over, there are a couple about pornography. It's a huge problem. And you said the question is not if a child will be confronted with it, but when. So how can we as parents, pastors, friends, engage kids about this issue? How can we create a place for conversation and healing? I mean, it seems insurmountable.
I know. It when you think about kind of our pornified world, mm-hmm. it is overwhelming as a parent, because it's not just, you know, some rated X website now. I mean, it seeps into the culture elsewhere. So mm-hmm. like Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Some online streaming platform or whatever. And so it is overwhelming. So I think there's a few things that we need to do. Number one, knowing that our kids almost with certainty are going to encounter it, we need to make sure there's a lot of grace in our homes. We need to make sure that they know that there's going to, we're going to point them back to Jesus mm-hmm. and his forgiveness and his mercy. They're going to need that, of course, all their lives. Mm-hmm. We do as well. So I think that's part of this is that making sure our homes are filled with grace and forgiveness and confession. And then protection as well. And that's one of our primary roles as parents. And so what we'll have to do, I think it's a minimum requirement for families to have internet filtering mm-hmm. on their, you know, their Wi-Fi and any device in the home. But filtering is not enough. Kids are so tech savvy these mm-hmm. days and get around that. So there also has to be monitoring as well. And so like in our family, we use a thing called Covenant Eyes, which is a software that you put on different mobile devices, different laptops, different computers, that also monitors what's, you know, going on, what sites are being visited, background data, if it's being done through apps. And so that's kind of a level of protection. And I think then realizing that this is, you know, it's no longer the talk anymore.
Yeah.
This is just an ongoing conversation.
Lifelong. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like, all right, I did the talk and I'm done with that. It is an ongoing conversation that has to be held constantly with your kids.
Say the name of the software that you use again.
It's called Covenant Eyes.
Okay. And then Do you have any, I mean, suggested rules for like phones are in a public space when you sleep at night or, you know, that kind of thing? Or is it sort of different for every family? And
yeah, well, in our family, what we've done is I've seen other people do this. So we created our own. We have a smartphone contract for our kids. And so we have certain rules in terms of technology for as the kids were younger. So for instance, like screen time, we limit like during the week, Monday through Friday. The general rule is there's no screen time for the younger ones. And this includes TV, this includes gaming, those kind of things. Now we make exceptions to those rules, mm-hmm. You know, for the kids. Like there's sometimes where it's like, hey, we'll do a family movie, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is a general rule. And what it helps with our kids is it helps just manage their expectations on this. So they're not constantly coming to us saying, can I get on this? Can I get on the screen? Can I play this game? There's a general expectation. And instead, and so here's the other thing is that we not only say no to screen time, but what we then want to do is fill that with things that are just better and richer. Mm-hmm. And so for us, books are a big part of our family's life. And so actually right before this podcast, my 9-year-old, right, mom is doing another recording. Dad's doing, you know, this podcast with you guys. We homeschool our kids. So he's at home, he's done with his morning work. So he came and asked me like, hey, Dad, can I can I play a game on the computer while you guys are, you know, mm-hmm. preoccupied? And there would be some times where I'd say yes, but it's Wednesday, middle of the week. So I just said, no, go listen to an audiobook.
Yeah.
And so he went in with his sister. And so I think it's important for us not to just always say no, 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 but also then to say, okay, yes to this. So you're saying no to this because there's something better. There's a yes over here. And so filling it with books, with art, with music, our kids, you know, take music lessons and play the piano and those kind of things. Oh gosh, I just lost my train of thought.
No, that's okay. I kind of want to move us on anyway, because we've spent a lot of, I mean, we could talk about this kind of stuff all day, but I really want to get back to this idea of people walking away from their faith. So we've talked a lot about cultural influence, but I want to kind of get back to this idea of reconstruction, right? I think it's pretty evident that a lot of people, especially in college, are going to do some kind of deconstruction of their faith. Like, oh, holy crap, do I believe what my parents believe? Do I vote like my parents? What does it all mean? You know? But the real question is, how do you then reconstruct that? So I want to just pick your brain a little bit about how we can help that process with our own kids, or just kids that are sort of in our orbit, how people go about reconstruction at all. What are sort of the right and wrong ways? And then at some point I want to talk a little bit about scripture. How is it that a scripture would ever be authoritative this day and age? It's like almost a ridiculous notion to be like, well, what does the Bible say about that? You know, it sounds stupid in 2020 to say, I mean, I hear myself say it to my kids sometimes, like they'll, you know, one will be rude to the other and then the other one will be rude back and be like, well, they just started it. I'm like, and does the Bible say that's how we're supposed to handle it? You know, return evil for evil. And they sort of roll their eyes. And I think we all kind of do that. Like, it's not relevant anymore. Don't be crazy. And yet, as Christians, we think it very much is relevant. So I know I just threw a bunch at you, but I really want to hear your thoughts on how people do reconstruction. And then, like, where does the Bible enter into that, maybe?
Yeah. You know, I think part of the thing that we want to do is help people also in the deconstruction side of things is help them navigate that, because I think that will play into the reconstruction side of things, right? So when someone's deconstructing their faith or rethinking it or doubting it, we want to, of course, give them space to do that and ask questions about anything. And at the same time, I think we want to communicate, well, there are parts of the faith that can't be deconstructed, right? There's a core of the faith, what we call orthodoxy, which if you deconstruct that, you know, then you no longer have the faith. So let's just be clear that there are these, you know, boundaries of orthodoxy, and you certainly have the freedom to reject those things. But once you reject certain things, then you no longer fall under the category of being a Christian. Mm-hmm. Right. So if I reject the deity of Christ, well, fine. But let's be clear that then moves you out of the Christian faith.
I think important. A lot of people have no problem being moved out of the Christian faith. The question is, then are they going to sort of start from scratch to figure out if they're coming back, or are they going to just kind of stay there? You know?
Yeah. Well, when people deconstruct to that level, because I think they're different. What I see is they're different levels of deconstruction.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, there will people who will deconstruct and they'll walk away from the faith. Mm-hmm. Those people typically aren't, at least in the near future, going to start reconstructing, right? So they're going to walk away and they're going to reject it wholesale often, and then walk away. But there are a group. So if you kind of think of it as spectrum, you've got those very serious deconstructors, and they're going to walk away. Then you have a group though that deconstruct the faith, but still want to hold on to the faith. And oftentimes they'll say things like, well, I still love Jesus, or I still follow the teachings of Jesus. And so then I think what we want to do there is okay, help them, I guess, really make sure that they know the teachings of Jesus, right? And so part of the questions there are, okay, well, where do you get your information about Jesus? Where do you discover the teachings of Jesus? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, where's their primary sources here?
Yeah.
And that will get us into conversations about the scripture and the nature of scripture. But I think laying some of those foundations for them to reconstruct, right? Because ultimately, when we talk about reconstruction, what we're after is we're after the truth of Christianity. I mean, that's right. What we want. And so then I think in that conversation, there's also sifting out. And this is why I think orthodoxy, the question of orthodoxy is so important, because there's a sifting out of, okay, what's the core of the Christian faith? Mm-hmm. And then what are some of the cultural things that we've imported into the Christian faith? And so we grow up with this in our different traditions, our different kinds of churches, our different families, where some might be reacting to certain political views
yep.
they think are necessary to be mm-hmm. part of the Christian faith, right?
Yeah.
And so we want to make sure, okay, if that's what they're deconstructing, great. But sometimes what happens is, like, you know, the cliche, throwing the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing, is that's what they'll do. Oh, if the Christian faith entails this view and this view and this view, well, then I'm going to just kind of throw the whole thing out. And so yeah. I think this is where careful thinking is important, and laying out what that core is, because then what we can do is we can help people deconstruct in healthy ways and help them see, yeah, this is not actually an essential to the Christian faith. This is where Christians can, maybe it's an issue of conscience where Christians have different views on this. Maybe it's just, maybe it has to do with how we see the Christian worldview working out, because we mm-hmm. certainly wouldn't want to say that there aren't things that are entailed, certain views, social views or political views that may be entailed by Christian ideas, but there's also room for some disagreement on some of those things.
Yeah.
You know, we just
have
to
secondary nature ism there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so what we want to help people do is kind of separate those things so that they don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And then we can kind of begin to lay a proper foundation for what reconstructing would look like. Mm-hmm. And maybe, so for instance, I mean, you know, the example I gave of my professor going after the reliability of scripture, and particularly he was kind of going after the doctrine of inerrancy, right? Here are mm-hmm. these errors in the Bible. Well, at that point, I just kind of assumed that inerrancy was essential to the truth of Christianity. But you could get rid of inerrancy and still have the resurrection of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, inerrancy isn't essential in that way to the Christian faith. Now, there are these secondary view issues, what we say aren't core. They're certainly significant. I think inerrancy yeah. is a significant issue.
Me too.
But the point is, I was thinking, if he dismantles inerrancy, then I may have to walk away from this thing.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have a proper kind of foundation to do some of that reconstructing, realizing what are the core pieces here.
Can I ask a kind of practical question about sort of keeping people engaged? So this is a big debate maybe, but kind of the way in which we separate children out for worship. And it might be something as innocuous as like putting small kids in the nursery during worship, but the larger the church is, the more segregated people get. You know, you've got groups, you know, five-year-old kids, six-year-old kids, you know, 30 people in their 30s who are single, people in their 30s who are divorced, you know, depending on how big the church is, you have like a group for everybody. But there are some churches who really prize and push for intergenerational worship. The children will always be in worship, even little screaming kids. And I think something like that makes it harder to leave. When I think about some of the, now I'm not saying we should be a cult, but when I do think about
some, I love when he starts sentences
yeah,
that way.
That's dangerous. But when you think about some of the social pressures of leaving, say, Mormonism or something, there is a very strong social pressure. And that's not necessarily good. It's not necessarily bad either. There should be a pressure to leaving Christianity. But if we've already segregated, they're already halfway out the door. So I don't know if you have any strong thoughts or thoughts on how we should do worship or, you know, the education. Let me give one quick example, then I promise I'll shut up. But my wife's sister is principal of a school in Kansas. They literally put a small elementary school inside of a nursing home. And I think the teacher whose idea this was won like teacher of the year last year. And so you have truly intergenerational teaching going on. Now, I don't know if COVID changed all that, but you get the idea. It was like, hey, we have space, we have a need. And the kids and the old people interact and everybody loves it. You know,
that is adorable. Yeah.
But in church, we do just the opposite. It's like, let's get everybody apart. So I don't know what the question is, but It seems like it would be harder to leave the faith if you have strong social connections within a church. And it seems like those connections would be stronger if we emphasized and tolerated children in worship and expected that.
Yeah, no, Evan, I'm completely on board with what you're saying here. This is one thing my wife and I have really wrestled with a lot, because for us as, you know, Christians in American culture, this is just how most churches structure themselves, right? And I think the church needs to step back, and church leadership needs to step back and say, wait a second, why are we doing this? Why, when I go to church, do my high schoolers go this way, my elementary kids go this way, and my wife and I, we go into, you know, big service, and the entire Sunday experience of worship and preaching of the word and the, you know, the sacraments, why are we completely separated during this time? And in fact, it's just the adults that take the sacraments. The kids don't even, you know, aren't exposed to that whatsoever, right? I think this is a huge problem for the way we've structured the churches. And there are a number of problems with it. But I think the first question is to ask leadership, why do we do this, right? Now, there may be some practical concerns about the screaming child or that kind of thing. Okay, is that enough for us? Is that reason enough for us to divide for the entire time? And then thinking through, like, yeah, the nature of the body, I think part of it too, I wonder if part of the reason is that we have absorbed secular cultural views about children mm-hmm. and about youth and their value, right? Mm-hmm. Even when we talk about serving in children's ministry, it's almost like you're relegated to that role, yes. right? Oh, you serve in children's ministry. Oh, how'd they get you to do that?
You're the short stick, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it betrays this secular view in terms of the value of children, they're more, you know, this kind of this approach of their means to an end kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so let's separate them off so we adults can do the real stuff, because we're the important ones. So I think there might be some stuff like that going on.
I will say that one of the reasons, the only defense of it I can really come up with would be that there are times when I want to talk about something like, say, pornography, that I'm not going to talk about that in a sermon, because I don't want their kid, you know, 6-year-old go, mommy, what's pornography? And, you know, they're not ready to have the talk yet. So we have other venues for that, you know, like Sunday school for adults and things like that. But
yeah, well, I don't think that separating out is never appropriate, mm-hmm. but I think what we should do, particularly since I think the pendulum has just swung the other way, it's probably what we should do is that we should figure out more and more ways to bring the entire congregation together. And I think there are multiple benefits to this. I think you mentioned one, just the ties to the community that do help prevent people from walking away. But then the mutual, and I think part of that is just the mutual discipling and mentoring that goes on amongst the community. And then the connecting of young people to wisdom of older mm-hmm. generations. Mm-hmm. And it almost seems like we've kind of, the way we've set up church, we've taken the cues from the culture, because this is how culture sets things up, right? It divides into these different age groups. That's how we do education. That's even in human history, that's a new invention, a new innovation in education, is separating them into mm-hmm. these different age groups. And so I think there'll be multiple benefits. So I think churches, you know, could do all kinds of things where, even if it's, let's say it's let's just take, you know, maybe the worship time where there's the, you know, praising God in worship and song, the kids are in for that and they're in for the announcements maybe during the sermon, you know, there's more, developmentally appropriate teaching that they can separate off for. I think that could work. But maybe if we're doing the sacraments, if we're taking communion, then the kids are brought back in to observe or participate in that. And so, I'm all for youth ministry. But we need to think of it as supplemental versus that's the mm-hmm. primary thing, because then kids, and we see this in so many churches, kids are separated for the first 18 years of their life from big church, the larger congregation. So when they graduate, they don't know how to plug in. They're not connected at all. And we see this all the time in even our own home church, is that then they just wander away. And there's this big age gap of these young people, these singles, college students who aren't really plugged into the church anymore. And of course, now they're making some really big decisions in life without the body of Christ around them, that community around them, to give them wisdom and guide them in that process. So I think that's a huge issue that the church needs to rethink.
Let's move, because we're already at an hour, which is crazy. Let's talk a little bit about, I want to hear a little bit about Maven. What is it? What does it mean? But I also want you, I selfishly want you to give me some tips for my own teenagers. How do we motivate students, youth, teens, college kids, whatever, to care about this kind of stuff, to care about theology, to care about worldview, or dare I even say apologetics? My kids hear this kind of stuff all the time, and they'll say things like, well, we hear you talk about it all the time, so we know it and we're good. But I don't think they really care about it. And of course, I can't force them to think it's as cool as I think it is and be like, let's read this Nabil Qureshi book together, you know? But how do you help people care about that kind of thing? And then tell us a little bit about Maven.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start with that second question there.
Yeah.
One thing this popped into my mind when you talked about them, you know, sometimes not caring, right? We always go through those seasons where the kids seem to apathetic about certain things that we want to teach. One thing that we have to do is parents and church leaders, is remember that we don't react simply, or we don't act upon their response. So there are going to be times when, yeah, your kids are going to, they're going to push back. They're not going to like it. And, you know, I'm still going to be faithful to God and how I'm supposed to raise you. And so just because you don't like this thing that we're doing doesn't mean I'm going to stop. And sometimes what happens is that for whatever reasons, our kids don't have an appetite for this thing right now, but it doesn't mean that they can't develop it. So for instance, one of the things that we developed, I would say, you know, a little bit later as parents, was a kind of a culture in our family where we would sing worship together. And we started teaching our kids hymns because we wanted them in touch with the great theology that's in so many hymns, right? And the way we started was sitting at our kitchen table, and we do this thing called morning time where we read through the scriptures together, but then we would start with a hymn. And so we'd find a good version on YouTube and play that and then sing to it together, right? And so we're doing this. And my son, who's now 19, he was probably like sixth grade at the time when we started this. And it was painful because you could clearly tell he did not want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
He did not want to sit there and sing out loud with his family, sing a hymn while it's playing on YouTube, right? And we could have said, it was discouraging his parents. And we could have said at that point, yeah, this is just not working. But we had younger kids, and we saw the younger kids were like, very early on, were like, they were into it. They were fine with that. That wasn't like weird, but for a junior high boy, it was weird, right? Because we hadn't developed that culture yet. And so we just persisted. And I would say it probably took a good year or so, if not longer, for him to begin to get comfortable with it. And so there was like very small steps of progress that we had to kind of hold on to. So it wasn't that he was, you know, he was sitting there anymore and with this mad look on his face, or this, you know, like apathetic look on his face. He was now, you know, you could see his demeanor had changed. Now, he wasn't singing really. He wasn't engaging in the singing yet, but that was progress. And through the years, what has happened is he's started to sing, and now he will worship with us, no problem. So it took time to develop that. So I think one thing to just encourage all of us on is that some of these things that we might know are good for our kids or right, is that even if their response is negative, it discourages us, we need to have a clear kind of conscience and clear view that we're going to persist in this because it's good for them. Even if ultimately they reject it at the end when they, you know, grow up and move out of the house. Yeah. I think one of the best things that we can do is start at very young ages, so that when they get into the teen years, this stuff is more normal and part of the culture, the family culture. So very early on, I think you're laying well, here are the kind of the three stages that helped me organize this with my own kids, with kind of the discipleship of my own kids. The first stage is really birth through, let's say it's fourth or fifth grade, where you're really focusing on teaching the what. So this is where you're giving them the theological foundation. And that's where you're teaching them doctrine, not just kind of the moralism we hear in so much of the church, but you're giving them the, you know, you're teaching them the nature of God. They're maybe memorizing the attributes of God. You're going through a catechism. You are having them memorize great pieces of scripture, the Ten Commandments, the, you know, the Lord's Prayer, these kinds of things. And basically what you're doing is you're pouring truth into them to lay a foundation that you'll keep building on. Now, when they get into the junior high years, middle school years, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, their minds begin to develop. They can start to think abstractly. And that's where they start asking the why questions. And sometimes, you know, parents will or church leaders will take that kind of as a threat, like they're questioning our authority. And sometimes, you know, they are. But often they want to know, okay, what are the reasons behind these things? And this is such a key process because it moves them into ownership if they can develop their own reasons for the stuff. And it's not just, hey, my pastor said so or my church leader said so, but now I have reasons for myself. And this is where something like apologetics becomes so vital, where you're giving them their own reasons to think these things are actually true. And so that's what you teach the what at that foundational stage, and you keep teaching the what for the rest of life, but then you add to it teaching the why.
Yeah.
And giving them the reason why. And then by the time they're in high school, I think there's another piece you add, and that's teach the how to. And the idea there is you get this stuff out of the classroom and you get it into real life. So how this has worked out in our own family is like Mormon missionaries show up at my door, right? You get the knock. Well, we don't, you know, send them on their way. We say, hey, let's set up an appointment. We want you to come back and talk to our whole family. So make sure all the kids are available. And we all sit down with that Mormon missionary. And beforehand, I do some prep with the kids and say, hey, here are things to think about. Here are questions to ask. And when the missionaries come over, you guys are going to do most of the talking, you know, and let them engage that way. When I was a youth pastor, what we would do is we teach our junior hires about a particular world religion. And then I would call up the local Buddhist temple and ask them to give our kids a tour of their Buddhist temple and have a Buddhist monk, tell our kids about Buddhism. There's one of the things that we do at Maven is we do these things we call immersive experiences. And for instance, I just spent last week with a group of 80 students from the Impact 360 Institute Gap Year program. We took them to Utah. And beforehand, they studied Mormon theology and Christian theology and scripture. And then we took them to Utah and we put them in situations where they were able to have conversations with Mormons. And what that does is it brings all the stuff to life. So if you have a kid who says, yeah, I know all this stuff, you know, that's probably because they've grown up in the church and they've just heard it, but they haven't been exposed to the challenges. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that when they get their faith challenged, when they go talk to a Mormon who seems to know the Bible better than they do,
yep,
then they wake up and they go, oh, I don't know as much as I thought. And then there's a teachability that comes with that. We do another immersive experience that focuses on apologetics. And what we do is training in apologetics. And then we take kids to Berkeley, California. And we have atheists that we've developed relationships with there. And we bring our atheist friends out and say, hey, have your best shot at these kids, give your best arguments. And then the kids have to dialogue with them. And then we debrief them and we train them. We go to the Unitarian Church. We go on to UC Berkeley's campus and they talk to skeptical students. And I think that part of it does a couple of things. Number one, it helps this to kind of have contact with real life out there. They talk to people who don't believe what they believe. It challenges them. So then it creates this felt need of, oh, I really need to know this stuff. It creates some motivation. It also helps us to model for them, okay, what is all this stuff that I've been learning? How does it get lived out? How does my theology actually become a view for life?
Yeah.
So that, for instance, when I talk to that atheist or that Buddhist, I'm really concerned not just about arguing, you know, these different points with him, but I'm also concerned with showing him respect and love. Why? Because my theology tells me that he's made in the image of God. And there's a certain way that you treat someone who's made in the image of God. And yeah. So it just brings all of it together. So teach the what, teach the why, teach the how to kind of is that, I think, the full package that we need in our discipleship of young people.
That's really good. I am already scheming about where I'm going to take my 16-year-old son. He's going to love it. I'll tell him Brett Kunkel told me to do it. I want to ask you so many more questions, but we are out of time. So let me do this. Why don't you direct people to where, if they want more information about all of the things that you do, where would they go to find you, learn about all of this?
Yeah. So our organization is Maven. A Maven is simply someone who is knowledgeable or an expert in a certain field of knowledge, and then they seek to pass that on to other people.
Isn't a maven a woman? Do I just have that in my head? Like, I think like a wise old woman.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's sometimes referred, I mean, with like some maybe more traditionally feminine things like fashion. You hear the word fashion maven.
Yeah.
Right? But you can have a finance maven or a business maven.
You're our tech maven, really, Evan.
Oh, is that what I am?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so... So that's what the word maven means. And that's what we want to be with Christian Truth is, you know, mavens of Christian Truth. And so people can find us at our website, which is maventruth.com. And we've got different resources there, different conferences that we do, different online resources. I would say a really good resource for parents and then for students are the books that we wrote. In fact, if I can do a shameless plug here.
Please do.
This book is a practical guide to culture. This is for the parents and the adults and the church leaders out there. The subtitle is Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. And it really takes kind of the culture and our worldview and how are we to live in this culture and then raise up kids to deal with these challenges. And we get into some of the very specific challenges like pornography, like homosexuality, like mm-hmm. gender identity, like race. And then we realized there's a need to write to students as well. So we did kind of a companion guide. It's a student's guide to culture, which we aim that right at students for students to read. And it's something that parents could read the adult version, the students could read the student version. And then it would, I think, help foster just a conversation mm-hmm. amongst parents and students as you read that together to kind of talk through and think through these tough challenges in culture.
Yeah. So, and I wish I had said this at the beginning of the episode, but a lot of our audience do not yet have children. They're young adults in their 20s, early 30s. But I would say if you've listened to the whole episode and you're still listening, you can be one of those people that, you know, draws the short stick and goes and helps with youth ministry in your own churches so that they can be equipped. I mean, if you're listening, you're probably a theology nerd. Take that theology nerdiness and let's, you can come to my house. I have a 16-year-old and an almost 14-year-old who would love to, and I would love to have the help. So, but my shameless plug is over and yours is over. So a couple places for people to find us. Of course, our new website, HoustonTOT.com. You can check us out there. Or of course, on Facebook, Facebook.com/TheologyOnTapHouston, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I always just start it and my computer finishes it. But until we see or hear from you next, we encourage you as always to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.